But I can't be sure, can I? Even babies recognize the people they know. Even dogs. Even Carl Jummers, who still, how many years after grade school, has to count on his fingers, and last year ate a cat turd because he was dared. One of the security guys appears, pushing people away, and also a teacher, gray hair, beard, who tries to restore order in the crowd. As he's telling them there's nothing to see here, go back to your business, another girl comes walking up fast.
Jack Maslin? What happened?
She's examining my face, and at this point I'm not sure where I'm bleeding from. Do I know this person? There's nothing about her that looks familiar, but then someone goes,
It was him, Ms. Chapman. He grabbed her.
I jerk my chin out of her hand. I say,
It's Mrs. Chapman.
And I look her right in the eye. In that moment, I'm like, Come on, lady. Show me what you got. Show me what makes you so special. I mean, there must be something incredible here, right? Why else would my dad put his family on the line and risk everything? But the only one who stands out from the staring, jabbering crowd of them isn't my own brother, or the woman who's wrecking my parents' marriage. It's a girl I don't even know. The largest girl here.
Libby. Principal Wasserman is a wiry jumping bean of a woman. A plaque behind her desk says she's been a principal for 25 years. I sit across from her, next to the boy and a woman who must be his mother. Principal Wasserman says to me, Your dad should be here any minute. Suddenly, I feel like I'm going to throw up because I've just gone reeling back in time to the worst moment of my life. I was in fifth grade, in the middle of a school assembly, when the principal found me and led me out of the auditorium in front of everyone. She took me to the office, where my dad was waiting along with a school counselor. A big box of Kleenex sat on the corner of the principal's desk, and that was what I focused on. It was such a big box, as if they'd created it especially for that moment. Your mom is in the hospital, and we have to leave now. What do you mean? He had to repeat it three times before I could understand, and even then I thought it was a terrible joke, that they'd all conspired for some reason to play this really cruel trick on me. Whoops. I look up as my dad walks in. Are you okay? I'm okay. Someone brings in a chair for him, and then the principal tells everyone what happened in the cafeteria. The boy's mom is staring at her son like he's Rosemary's baby. She says, There's got to be some sort of explanation as to why on earth you would do such a thing. My dad says to her, I'd like to hear the explanation that could make me understand this. The principal speaks over them. I want to hear from Jack and Libby. Everyone looks at us. He grabbed me. How did he grab you? He launched himself at me and held on like I was a flotation device and he was the last man off the Titanic. This boy, Jack, clears his throat. That's not exactly how it happened. I raise an eyebrow at him. Really? But he's not looking at me. He's too focused on trying to seduce Principal Wasserman. He leans forward in his chair and talks in this low, drawling voice, like he's conspiring with her. It was stupid. The whole thing was stupid. Is stupid. He glances at his mom. The past couple of years haven't been so easy. He looks at Principal Wasserman in this super intense way, like he's trying to hypnotize her. I'm not saying there's any excuse for what I did, because I doubt there's anything I can say to you to justify what happened out there. He's a snake charmer, this one. But lucky for me, Principal Wasserman isn't a fool. She cuts him off and turns to me. I'd like to hear what precipitated the punch in the mouth. My dad goes, You punched him? As evidence, Jack points to his face. I say, He grabbed me. Technically, I hugged her. It wasn't a hug, it was a grab. Principal Wasserman goes, Why did you grab her, Jack? Because I was being an idiot. I didn't mean anything by it. I wasn't trying to scare her. Wasn't trying to bully her. I wish I had a better reason, believe me. His eyes are going, "You will forgive me. You will forget this ever happened. You will love me as all the others do." Did you feel threatened, Libby? I didn't feel great, if that's what you're asking. But did you feel threatened, sexually? Oh, my God. No, just humiliated. Even more so now, thanks. Because we don't take sexual assault lightly. Jack's mother leans forward in her chair. Principal Wasserman, I'm an attorney, and I'm as concerned as you are, if not more so, about what's transpired here today, but until we... Principal Wasserman says again, I want to hear from Jack and Libby. Next to me, I can feel the life go out of this boy. I glance over at him, and he looks like a shell. Like someone came along and sucked away every ounce of his blood. For whatever moronic reason he grabbed me, I know he didn't mean it like that. So I say, it wasn't sexual, at all. I never felt threatened in that way. But you hit him. Not because I felt assaulted.
Why did you hit him then?
Because he grabbed me in a totally non-sexual but still really annoying and humiliating way. The principal folds her hands on her desk. Her eyes are fixed on us like she'd turn us to stone, if only she could. Fighting on school property is a serious charge. So is vandalism. And it takes me a minute. She holds up a scan of a photograph which I don't need to look at because I already know what's there. She says to Jack,
"Do you know anything about this?"
He leans forward to study the picture, sits back again, shaking his head.
"No, ma'am, I do not."
"Ma'am." My dad leans in.
"Let me see that, please."
As he takes the piece of paper, Principal Wasserman says,
"I'm afraid someone has defaced one of our school bathrooms with derogatory comments about your daughter. I assure you it is going to be dealt with. I don't take something like this lightly either."
She looks at Jack again. His mom looks at him. My dad looks at him. His jaw tensing so much I'm worried it will crack in half. I will myself to become invisible. I shut my eyes, as if this might help. When I open them again, I'm still in the chair, and everyone is staring at me. I say, "Sorry?" My dad waves the scan.
"Do you know who did this?"
I want to say no. Absolutely not.
"Libs?"
Here's my choice. I can lie and say no. I can tell them Jack did it. Or I can tell the truth. Yes.
"Yes, you know who did it?"
"Yes." Everyone waits. It was me. It takes them a minute. The boy whistles. His mom says,
"Jack? Sorry, but..."
He whistles again. Principal Wasserman's face has fallen, and I can imagine her sitting down with her husband tonight, telling him how kids have changed, how we break her heart, how it's a good thing she's almost retired because she doesn't know that she can do this much longer. My dad says,
"Why, Libby?"
And maybe it's the way he says Libby instead of Libs, but for some stupid reason, I'm about to cry. Because someone was going to write it. And suddenly, I feel naked. Like I might as well be laid out on a dissecting table. Insides exposed to the world. There's no way I can ever explain to anyone other than my dad the importance of being prepared. Of always being one step ahead of everyone and everything. Better to be the hunter than the hunted. Even if you're hunting yourself. My eyes meet Jack's. Something like that.
And then I come along to prove your point.
He holds my gaze for a few seconds, and then we both look away. We sit there, the five of us, in the most awkward silence of my life until the principal says,
"There are several different punishments I could give you. Suspension. Expulsion. In some cases, schools in Rushville and Newcastle have even called in local police to make arrests." Jack goes, "How about we let my punishment be that the entire school saw a girl kick my ass?" "Or we can prosecute you for bullying," she says to him. Jack's mother, the attorney, nearly falls off her chair. "Before we talk about prosecuting," Principal Wasserman speaks over her, "and you, Libby, for fighting."
"It was self-defense!" My voice booms out, too loud and high. "When I punched him, I mean."
Although the bathroom was about self-defense, too. The principal nods at Jack. "Had he let go of you by the time you hit him?"
"Only because I pulled him off me."
She shakes her head and sighs for 3 days. "I'm not going to make my decision right now. I want to talk to witnesses. I need to look at your records, weigh the options. But I want to make it clear that I have a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to violence, bullying, or anything that even hints at sexual harassment." She narrows her eyes at Jack, then at me. "I'm not too crazy about vandalism, either."
Jack. We're told to wait outside Wasserman's office. The security guard and the bearded teacher go in as we come out, along with a couple of kids. God knows who. Maybe my own brother. Libby and I sit side by side on a bench. I watch the door leading out of here, into the main hall. And all I can think is, don't let Monica Chapman walk in. Not with my mom in there. Libby looks at me. "Why did you do it?" I want to say, read the letter. But right about now, that letter seems like the second worst idea I've ever had. Haven't you ever done something mean or stupid without thinking it through? Something you instantly regretted as soon as you did it? She doesn't answer. So I say, sometimes people are just shitty. Sometimes they're shitty because they're afraid. Sometimes they choose to be shitty to others before others can be shitty to them. Like self-defensive shittiness. Because my brain is damaged. Because I'm damaged. Why me? Or should I ask? You shouldn't ask. There's no way in hell I'm saying the words "fat girl rodeo" to her. She rolls her eyes and looks away. You don't think they'll suspend us? Or expel us? She says this toward the other side of the room. No. This isn't my first, I almost say rodeo, but stop myself. We'll be okay. Although honestly, I'm not so sure. Her eyes meet mine again, and I smile at her. Even as I'm hating myself, and my lip starts bleeding. Does it hurt? Yeah. Good. An hour or so later, the door to the principal's office opens. And Principal Wasserman, short gray hair, glasses, waves us back in. Two men lean against the windowsill. One of them is a giant, and the other is pretty skinny. Libby's dad fixes me with a look. He is broad-shouldered like Charles Bronson, and I feel the need to say, "I'm sorry, sir." Libby and I drop into our usual chairs. I catch my mom's eye, and she shakes her head. She wears her hair one of two ways, and today she is mom with hair up. I may not be able to recognize faces, but I can tell when someone is disappointed and furious, and my mom is both. I think of all the times mom has told me to stay out of trouble, that people will be harder on me because of the way I look. I know I've let her down, and she will say I've let myself down. The gray-headed woman props her elbows on the desk and leans forward. I'm not going to suspend you or expel you. Not this time. Instead, the two of you will perform community service together. Only instead of doing this for the community, it will be community-type service for the school. We're putting you in charge of painting the bleachers and the locker rooms. Mr. Sweeney will supervise. The giant nods at us.
The two of you will also meet with the counselor every day after school for the next few weeks. The conversation circle is being used effectively at more and more schools across the country, and I believe it will also be effective here. It's important that you learn from the experience and each other. Mr. Levine, the skinny guy waves, specializes in some of the most prevalent issues affecting teens today, including bullying, prejudice, and sexual harassment. I clear my throat, which still feels raw. I don't think it's fair to punish her for something I instigated. I'd rather serve the time for both of us. Libby goes, "You are unbelievable." "What?" "You don't get to be the villain and the hero." Principal Wasserman says, "Thank you, Jack, but Libby broke the rules as well." As we leave, I try to say I'm sorry again, but Libby's father wraps his arm around her shoulders and steers her away. In the parking lot, my mom says, "We'll discuss this at home, Jack Henry." My full name. Something she hasn't called me in years. She drives off without another word. I go directly to Maslin's, hoping to slink in and bypass everyone, namely my dad. I'm barely settled behind the office desk when he comes walking in. "I heard what happened today. What the hell were you thinking?" I tell him I don't know, that it was meant to be a prank, but it ended up being a really stupid idea, and I wish I hadn't done it. And all the other things I've spent the past few hours saying over and over. "Your mother and I are disappointed in you." As if he needs to tell me this. I want to say, "I'm disappointed in you too." But instead I say, "I know. I'm sorry." When I'm finally alone, I turn on my phone. It immediately blows up with voicemails and texts. There's Caroline, Seth, Bailey, Bishop, Cam, and about 100 other people, including Marcus, who know all about what happened. Bailey Bishop is crying because she can't believe I would do something so hurtful to another human being. Caroline talks mostly about herself, but my brother actually wants to know if I'm okay and what happened with the principal. Cam's message says, "Congrats, princess. You win. Choose the place so we can take your sorry ass out for a victory meal. But hey, do me a favor, and don't get your ass kicked by any other girls before then." Followed by an entire minute of laughter.
Libby. The radio is playing, but the volume is low, and my dad is talking on and on. When he brings up homeschooling again, I say, "You don't need to worry about me. I can take care of myself."
"You really punched him?"
"Right in the mouth." And then he laughs. "Are you laughing?"
"I think I am."
"You're not supposed to laugh. You're supposed to tell me violence never solves anything and take away my phone or something."
"Don't punch anyone again. And if it makes you feel better, give me your phone."
And he just keeps on laughing. And now I'm laughing, too. And for the first time in a long time, I feel normal, weird as that sounds. We feel normal. Which makes me think what happened today wasn't so bad after all, and maybe all the humiliation and the upcoming hours of community service and counseling are worth this single moment. As we pull up to our house, Dad says,
"Don't let that boy get in your head. Don't let him take away what you've worked so hard for."
"I won't. I'm getting up tomorrow and going back to school." I look down at my shoes and the quote written there. "You can't stop living."
Jack. I find Dusty in his room playing video games. He's got his headphones on, and I can hear the music blasting through them. The Jackson 5, which he only listens to when he's feeling his absolute worst. I wave at Dusty, and finally he looks up and mouths,
"What?"
I mime removing headphones. I make it elaborate and exaggerated, hoping he'll laugh. He ignores me. I start to dance. Dusty can't resist dancing. The song is Rockin' Robin, and I don't hold back. I just go for it. I'm twisting and grooving across the floor. I'm in a music video. I'm Michael Jackson in his prime. I am the man. I'm the man, I say, loud enough so we can hear. I shake out the lion fro, making it as big as possible.
You're not the man,
he says it too loud, the way you always do when you're listening to the Jackson 5 at full volume through headphones.
I am the man.
I'm doing dance moves, ones he taught me. I purposely do them wrong because he won't be able to help himself. He makes me sweat it for another 30 seconds, and then he's up, and the headphones are off, and he starts showing me the correct steps. We finish the song, dancing in unison, and it's awesome. But then the song is over, and Dusty drops onto his bed and gives me this look that lets me know we're only in unison on the dance floor, nowhere else. Just to drive the point home, he goes,
You're not the man.
I guess not. I sit next to him, and we both stare at the floor.
So, which is it?
Which reason made you do this shitty thing? I think through all the reasons I listed before. Sometimes they're just shitty people. Sometimes people have been shitty to them. Sometimes they're shitty because they're afraid. Sometimes they choose to be shitty to others before others can be shitty to them. Sometimes someone doesn't like who he is, but then here's this other kid who knows exactly who he is, and that can make that first kid feel even worse about himself. Maybe all of them. But I meant what I said. I'll never be shitty to you. Then he looks at me, and he might as well knock me in my split lip, because he goes,
You need to make it right.
I know.
Libby. My dad finds me in the kitchen eating standing up, and this is something we don't do anymore. It's one of the food rules we follow, along with don't eat in front of the TV, don't eat too fast, and stop eating when you're 60% full. When I see him, I set the plate down. Wherever the ache is coming from, my heart, my stomach, the food isn't reaching it. When my mom went away, I went empty too. Like all of me just flooded out and disappeared. In the hospital, I held her hand until my grandmother came in, and my dad, and the rest of my family. All of them sweet and loving and brokenhearted. But none of them like my mom. Not even all together. They didn't begin to add up to her. My dad's eyes go to the plate, but he doesn't comment. Instead, he says, Bailey Bishop is here to see you. Bailey stands in the center of my bedroom, head turning, hair catching the light like it's trying to grab all of it and keep it for itself. It's been a long time. She leans down to rub George under his chin, and surprisingly, he lets her. Traitor, I think. Bailey says, Didn't you have him back then? I got him when I was 8. My mom and I picked him out, or rather he picked us. We went to a rescue event, and George got free of his cage and packed himself into my mom's purse. He was supposed to die 4 years ago, but he's not ready. The last time Bailey was at my house, we were 10. I had invited her and Monique Benton and Giselle Villegas for a sleepover. The four of us stayed up all night and talked about boys and told each other our deepest, darkest secrets. Bailey's was that she tried to give her baby brother away when he was born. Mine was that I sometimes spied on the boys who lived across the street. This was before Dean, Sam, and Castiel became my only friends. Bailey straightens and focuses all of her Bailey-ness on me and says, I'm sorry I never came to see you. I should have come to see you when you were in here. Well, not in here, but in your old house. This throws me completely, and I stand there like a lump. How does she get to be so nice and also have hair like that? Finally, I go, That's okay. I mean, we weren't best friends or anything. But we were friends. I should have come. Should I hug her? Should I tell her it's okay? Should I tell her she should have come to see me a long time ago, way before I was trapped in my house, when my dad first pulled me out of school and let me stay home? She says, I have to tell you something, and it's horrible, but I don't want you to have to hear about it at school. All of a sudden, she looks like she's going to cry, and at first I think she's going to tell me she's dying, or maybe I'm dying. And then she tells me about the game, how I was the grand prize in something called Fat Girl Rodeo, and how that news has spread across social media like a virus. Everyone is infected, and my 2,000 classmates and many, many strangers are all weighing in, get it? About whether they're Team Libby or Team Jack. Someone's posted a picture of me, which they must have snapped just after it happened, because there I am in the cafeteria, looking mad as a hatter, fist still clenched. Jack Maslin sprawled at my feet. You can't see his face, but you can see mine. Dangerously red, slightly sweaty.
Caption: Don't mess with Mad Libs. Libs, spelled LBS, as in pounds, of course.
There are 76 comments, and only a few of them are nice. The rest say the usual. If I was that big, I'd want to kill myself. And, she's pretty for a fat girl. And, just looking at her makes me want to never eat again. And simply, lose weight, you fat whore. This is exactly why I don't do social media. So many mean comments and snarky comments and bullying disguised as, I'm only expressing my opinion as the Constitution of our great country requires me to do. If you don't like it, don't read it, blah, blah, blah. I have this overwhelming urge to throw Bailey's phone away and my phone away and then go up and down the street collecting phones so I can throw them away, too. Bailey says, maybe I shouldn't have said anything. She chews on a fingernail and squints up her eyes, and I can see the tears in them. I'm glad you did. I mean, I'm not happy, obviously, but I was going to find out somehow, and being told by the world's kindest person is probably the best way to do that. I turn my phone off, and then I shut down the computer so I can't read about myself anymore. I say to Bailey, I am sick of reading about myself. She nods in her eager-to-please Bailey way. I start pacing, which means I'm about to start talking. A lot. For one thing, there's only so much new material you can get from the fact that I'm overweight. We get it, people. Move on. Bailey nods like crazy. We get it. And this whole pretty for a fat girl thing? I mean, what is that? Why can't I just be pretty, period? I wouldn't say, oh, Bailey Bishop, she's pretty for a skinny girl. I mean, you're just Bailey, and you're pretty. Thank you. You're pretty, too. And unlike Caroline and Kendra, I know she means it. And what is this whole fat girl equals whore bullshit? She flinches. Sorry. Fat girl equals whore garbage. What is that? Why am I automatically a whore? How does that even make sense? It doesn't. If everyone who had something to say about me spent as much time on, I don't know, practicing kindness or developing a personality or a soul, imagine how lovely the world would be. So lovely. I go on and on, Bailey as my cheerleader, until I run out of steam. I sink down onto my bed and say, why are people so concerned with how big I am? She doesn't answer, just takes my hand and holds it. She doesn't need to answer because there is no answer. Except that only small people, the inside small kind, don't like you to be big.
Jack. I've never built a robot before, but I'm determined. I watch a couple of YouTube videos, consult a couple of books. By the time I'm done, I've decided it's going to be the best damn Lego robot ever. For my 8th birthday, I asked for a hammer, screwdrivers, and wire cutters. I got my first soldering iron when I was 9. No one knows where this urge to build comes from, except that my dad has always been pretty handy. So maybe I get some of it from him. I just know that ever since I was little, Making things out of thin air is what centers me. Like the way other people turn to yoga or morphine. It's why we have a pizza oven and a pitching machine in our backyard, a catapult in our garage, and a weather station on the roof. When I'm working, I see the object as a whole before it ever exists, and I build my way there. It's the exact opposite of my everyday life. But right now, all I see are the pieces, which is exactly like my everyday life. Red ones here, blue ones there, white and yellow and green and black. At some point, I lie back on top of them, right on the cold concrete floor. It's uncomfortable as hell, but I tell myself, you don't deserve comfort, asshole. I wonder what Libby Strout is doing right about now. I hope she's not thinking about me or today. I hope somehow she can think about something else, anything else. I hear footsteps on the basement stairs, and a woman appears. First her legs, then the rest of her. I assume it's my mom, because what other woman would be in the house? Unless Dad's decided to bring Monica Chapman in here. I look for the identifiers. This is Mom with hair down. Her mouth is wide. She's clearly black. I try to build my way to her face. But even after I locate enough pieces to tell myself, okay, that's her, it's not as if the image of her snaps into place for me. And it's not as if it sticks around. I suddenly feel old and so, so tired. It's exhausting, constantly having to search for the people you love. She says, I don't need to tell you how disappointed I am in you, or how angry. You do not. I look up at her from the floor. We have to hope they don't decide to press charges. You may not see yourself as black, and you may not think people see you as black, but it's a fact that our society treats kids of color more severely than others. And I do not want this following you for the rest of your life. We're both quiet as I think about my dismal dead-end future. She says, What are you doing? I was preparing to build a Lego robot for little man. But right now I'm contemplating what an asshole I am. That's a start. How are you going to make this better? I don't think there's any making it better, is there? There's just making it as good as I can after the fact. Is there anything you want to talk about? Anything you need to tell me? Not tonight. Maybe not ever. My phone buzzes on the floor next to me. Get your call. You can tell me tomorrow. Maybe. She adds, I love you anyway. I love you anyway, too.
Libby. It's almost 9 when Bailey leaves. I'm still fired up, so I dance for a while, and then I decide to do homework. I dump the contents of my backpack onto my bed and sort through my papers and notebooks and pens and gum wrappers and all the miscellaneous rubbish I've stuffed in there. Including, we have always lived in the castle, which I carry everywhere. Buried in the mess is a white letter-size envelope. What's this? I rip it open and start reading. I'm not a shitty person, but I'm about to do a shitty thing. At first I think he's making it up. I read the letter again, and again. You know how it's easy to believe everything is about you, especially when something goes wrong? Why me? Why do I have the worst luck ever? Why is the universe so mean? Why does everyone hate me? My mom used to say sometimes it's actually about the other person and you just happen to be there. Like sometimes the other person needs to learn a lesson or go through an experience, good or bad, and you're just an accessory in some way, like a supporting actor in whatever their scene happens to be. Maybe, just maybe, this whole nightmare is more about Jack Maslin than it is about me. Maybe this whole thing happened to teach him a lesson about how to treat other people. I sit and think on that for a while. This was the thing Mom did. Looked at all sides of things. She believed that situations and people were almost never black and white.
10 minutes later, I'm reading everything I can find on prosopagnosia, which leads me to an artist named Chuck Close, neurologist/author Oliver Sacks, and Brad Pitt. According to the internet, they all have face blindness. I mean, Brad Pitt. What if the entire world was face blind? If everyone had prosopagnosia, there'd be hope for the homely. No one would ever say, "You're too pretty to be fat," or "She's pretty for a fat girl," because looks would stop mattering. Would people still care if you were overweight or too thin? Tall or short? Maybe. Maybe not. But it would be a step in the right direction. At Fat Camp, we had to try to put ourselves into the skin of other people, just like Atticus told Scout. You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb inside of his skin and walk around in it. Skin's so fascinating anyway. I mean, the way it expands and shrinks. I used to weigh twice what I do now. That's 2 times more. And my skin fit me then, and it fits me now. Weird. I try to put myself in Jack Maslin's skin and imagine what he sees when he looks at me. Do I look different in some way from everyone else? Or do I blend in? Then I imagine that I'm the one with face blindness. What would the world look like? I pull up a new document. I write, "Dear Jack, thanks for explaining your douchiness. I don't think prosopagnosia gives you the right to be a jerk, but I'm at least glad you're not rotten to your core. Maybe there's hope for you. Libby. P.S. I have questions."
Jack. On the other end of the phone, Cam says, "I wish you could have seen it. The look on her face when you threw yourself around her, and then when you just hung out there and wouldn't let go." I force out this kind of half-hearted laugh that sounds like I'm being strangled. "Man, I bet she looked surprised. As surprised as that chicken psycho when Norman Bates interrupts her shower. So what did Wasserman say?" "Oh, she was really fucking thrilled. Community service and counseling. For weeks." "Shit. I know. But it was worth it," says the man who doesn't have to do it. He's laughing again. "Wait. It gets better." "Great. Remember the girl who got cut out of her house a couple of years ago? What about her?" "That's her." "Who?" "Libby Strout. She's the one you rodeoed." I feel like I've been punched in the face again. "Are you sure?" I try to sound like I don't really give a shit, but here's the thing. I do give a shit. I give 5 million shits, which is why I feel like I'm going to be sick all over these Legos. "Oh, I'm sure." He's laughing. I do my strangle laugh again, only it sounds worse this time. "Man, you sound rough. I think she broke my throat." "So do you remember her?" "Yeah, I do." Outside, the neighborhood is asleep. I climb out my window and into the tree that acts as a ladder to the roof. I snake all the way up it until I'm there. And then I walk to the edge over by the gutter. My weather station is anchored near the chimney, battered and lopsided. When I was 6, I fell off the roof and cracked my head open. Without thinking, I reach up to feel the scar. I run my fingers along it as I stare across the street. If I stand here long enough, I can see it. The gaping hole where the front wall of her house used to be.
3 years earlier.
Jack, age 14. I dream that the street's on fire. And then I wake up to sirens. I lie still and listen as they come blaring toward the house. It's end of days dark in here, but suddenly the ceiling flashes red, and the sirens whine to a stop. I'm up and out of bed and grabbing shit off my dresser and bookshelves before I even know what's happening. On my way out, I fall headfirst into the hallway. where I hear but don't see my dad, who says from the black recesses of his bedroom, "It's not us. Go back to bed." But the dream was so damn real that I'm still half in it, and I keep right on going. Outside, the air is cold but smells clean. No fire, no smoke. I'm still holding the shit I grabbed, my granddad's watch, my retainer, a stack of baseball cards, my phone charger, but no phone, and of course there's no jacket. It's the house across the street. Rolling up in front is this line of fire trucks, an ambulance, two police cars. I figure it must be drug lords or a meth lab or maybe even a terrorist. I think it would be really damn cool to have a terrorist on our street because Amos, Indiana is one boring-ass place. Whose house is that? It's Mom behind me.
Strom? Stein?
This from Dad. Strout, says Marcus, who's 12, almost 13, and knows everything. I say before he can, the Strouts moved out years ago. The house has been empty since then. You never see anyone coming or going.
No, they didn't.
My other brother, Dusty, 7, is hopping on one leg.
Tams and me went over last week and looked in the windows.
Dusty. Mom shakes her head.
What? We wanted to see the fat girl.
We don't say fat. It's not polite.
Teacher says fat is an adjective, just like beautiful or handsome. It's only people that make it a bad word by saying, "Listen up, fatso," or, "Hey, look at that fat ass."
Mom frowns at my dad like, "He's your fault." And he says,
"Dustin,"
in a warning tone. But I can tell he's trying not to laugh. I say, "Mrs. Buckley?" Dusty stares up at me, still on one leg. He nods, I nod. That's about right. Mrs. Buckley is a very large woman.
Jack,
Mom sighs. My mom is always sighing. Let's go. Back inside. It's cold. You've got school tomorrow. If we don't stop her, she'll list 101 reasons why we need to get off this lawn. Just then another fire truck comes roaring up, siren blaring. And then this white truck comes lumbering along behind. And this one's pulling a crane. A crane. We watch in silence as the firefighters and police and these construction workers, who suddenly seem to be everywhere, set up giant spotlights. The front door to the house opens and closes, and people are moving like ants, scrambling across the yard and disappearing inside and blocking off the street. By now, all the lights on the street are on, and every lawn is covered with gawkers. We're directly across from it all. Front row seats. A man walks toward us, hands in pockets, glancing over his shoulder at all the commotion. He says to me,
"Can you believe this?"
He nods over at the house. "I really can't," I say. And then Dad goes,
"I thought that house was empty."
He says it to the man, who falls in beside him, and they stand side by side watching. There's an ease to it that makes me think my dad must know him. And then my mom calls the man Greg and asks about his daughter Jocelyn, the one at Notre Dame. And that's how I know it's Mr. Wallen, our next-door neighbor. I stand there surrounded by the fire trucks and the spotlights and that giant crane, ruminating on my brain and how it's so weirdly, strangely different from Marcus's or Dusty's or the brain of anyone else I know. It's so weirdly, strangely different that for the past year, I've been writing about it. Not my life story, but a sort of, this is me, this is what I think log, because I like to understand how things work. Other brains are simple and uncomplicated, and there's room in them for Mr. Wallen and his daughter Jocelyn, whereas my brain seems to be made for bigger things. Baseball, physics, aeronautical engineering, maybe president. This is the reason I don't watch a lot of TV or movies. I tell myself my brain is too busy thinking important things to keep track of the characters. I watch as a news van rolls in, all the way from Indianapolis. And think again, terrorists. I mean, what else could it be?
Libby, age 13. It's the feeling of being suffocated. What being strangled must be like. My world has tilted away and gone light and floaty. And maybe it's actually more like floating in space. I try to move my head, my arms, my legs, but I can't. When I was little, my mom read me this story about a girl who lived in a garden and was never allowed outside the walls. The garden was all she knew, and to her, that was the whole world. I'm thinking about this girl now as I'm trying to breathe. I see my dad's face, but he looks 100 years away. Like I'm circling the moon and he's down on Earth. And I'm trying to remember the name of the story. I suddenly need to remember. This is what happens when people die. They start to disappear if you don't watch it. Not all at once, but a piece here, a piece there. Think. The father was Italian. Rappaccini. Rappaccini's daughter. Did the girl have a name? I try to raise my head so I can ask my dad, but he says, "Stay very still," from way down on Earth. "Help is coming, Libby." Not Libby, I think. Rappaccini's daughter. I am here in my garden, and the world has stopped, and my heart has stopped. And I am all alone. Then I hear something that brings me back to this planet, this town, this neighborhood, this street, these four walls. The sound of the garden being torn away. The sound of my world crumbling.
Jack, age 14. 5 hours later, the top half of the house has been demolished by a team of sledgehammers and circular saws. The emergency workers have erected scaffolding and a long, wide bridge up to the second floor window. They fitted supports to keep the roof from collapsing, and when the sun comes up, they unroll this black tarp and circle the house with it. For privacy, I guess. It's clear that something needs to come out of there, and whatever it is, it's big. I sit on our roof so I can see right over the tarp. An enormous stretcher. I'm not sure what else to call it. It's hauled out of the truck and rolled up onto the bridge. The emergency workers are racing back and forth, and a handful of them anchor the stretcher in place. And then the crane goes cranking forward and reaches its claw into the bowels of the house. The tree outside my bedroom window suddenly starts to shake, and a head appears. This skinny little kid pulls himself up next to me. "Move over," he says. I make room for him, and together we sit there. We watch as the claw comes up and out, and inside the claw is a pair of arms and a pair of legs.
"Is she dead?"
Dusty whispers. "I don't know." The arms start waving and the legs begin kicking. It's like King Kong clutching Andaro. "Not dead," I say. The crane sweeps around till it's above the bridge, and all that scaffolding, and then lowers itself over the stretcher. Very gently, like it's playing a game of pickup sticks, the crane releases the arms and legs until I can see that they belong to a girl. The largest girl I've ever seen.
"Tall view,"
Dusty says.
Libby, age 13. The sky is bright and blinding. It's like I've never seen it before. And oh, it's so beautiful, and I'm alive. I'm alive. If I die right now, at least I've seen the sky like this, all blue and brilliant and new. My chest is still clenching, but some of the clenching releases, and it's because these nice men and women are here, and I'm not dead, and I'm not going to die in there, in that house. Not to say I won't die here in the yard, but at least the air is fresh, and I can breathe. And there are trees, and sky, and birds. And over there a cloud, a fluffy one, and there is the smell of something. Flowers, maybe. I want to say, look at me, Dean, Sam, Cass, I'm out here just like you. And then I think how they're my only friends, even though they don't know it. And oh my God, I'm crying again. But then I must pass out because when I wake up, I'm being bumped all around, and I'm in the back of a truck, not even an ambulance like a regular person. I stare up at dingy metal instead of blue, and all at once I feel humiliated. How many people did it take to break me out? I try to ask my dad, who sits back against the rattling metal wall, head jostling up and down, but his eyes are closed, and I can't speak, and suddenly I think, what if I never speak again? Dad opens his eyes and sees me staring at him, and he smiles, but he's not fast enough. My chest is clenching tighter and tighter, and I don't want to be here in this truck. I want to be in my bed, in my room, in my house. I don't want to be out here, in this world. I want to say, take me home, please, if there's anything left of it. But then something sweeps over me, and it's this kind of quiet, peaceful feeling. And that's her. That's my mom. I breathe slower, to try to make it last, to try to keep her with me. Live. 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 I think it as hard as I can before everything goes black. And as I drift off, I remember. Rappaccini's daughter. Beatrice. Her name was Beatrice.
Jack, age 14. When I get home from school that day, a security vehicle is parked in front, and a guard sits behind the wheel, sound asleep. I check to see if anyone is looking, and then I walk right in. There's only half the living room. The sofa is oversized and drooping in the middle like a hammock. A framed picture lies face up on the floor, and it's of a man and a woman and a little girl. The girl is out of focus, and you can tell she's laughing. In the photo, she's just a regular-sized kid. The kitchen is a typical kitchen. For the most part, it's intact, only a little dust. I go to the fridge first because I can't help it. I want to see what's in there. I expect a banquet suitable for Henry VIII, but it's just your run-of-the-mill stuff. Eggs, milk, deli meat, cheese, diet sodas, juice. On the outside of the door is a single magnet. Ohio welcomes you. I walk through the whole house. It's smaller than ours, and it doesn't take me long to find her bedroom, even though part of the front wall is missing. I don't go in because it doesn't feel respectful. Instead, I stand in the doorway. The walls, the ones that are left, are lavender, and there are bookshelves, floor to ceiling, on every single one. The books look like they might spill out and overtake the room, maybe the whole house. The bed is the focal point of the room and looks specially built. It's a king-size bed that pretty much fills all the space. It sits on top of this metal, steel platform, and beside it is a single pair of slippers. It's the slippers that get me. They look delicate, like they were made for a girl Dusty's age. The sheets have daisies on them, and they're thrown all around, as if a tornado's blown through. One of the pillows lies on the floor. A stack of books sits by the bed, and it takes me a second to see that these are 6 copies of the same book. We Have Always Lived in the Castle, by Shirley Jackson. Although the bindings are different. I think she must really love that book. When I leave, I try not to touch anything except for one copy of the Shirley Jackson book and the Ohio magnet, both of which I take. I don't know why. Maybe it makes me feel closer to the girl who lives there. Outside, the guard is still sleeping, and I rap on the glass to wake him up. When he rolls down the window, I say, "Stay alert, buddy. I imagine everything they own is in that house, and they've been through enough without losing it to looters." Of course, the book and magnet don't count. I knock on the door of Marcus's room and then walk on in. His walls are covered with posters, mostly of basketball players. There's a hoop attached to the closet door. A gangly, shaggy-haired kid hunches on the floor in front of his computer. He's playing a video game, the shoot everyone and blow shit up kind. I do what I usually do. Look for the signs that this is my brother. The pointy chin, the messy hair, the mopey expression. I look for the pieces and put them together because this is how I know it's him. "Can I ask you a question?"
"What?"
He doesn't take his eyes off the screen. "How do you remember people so well? How do you tell them apart?"
"What?"
"Take Squinty. Her name's Patrice. Whatever, Patrice. How do you pick her out of a crowd?"
"She's my girlfriend?"
"I know she's your girlfriend. Do you know what she'd do to me if I couldn't pick her out of a crowd?"
"Yeah,
but what is it about her that tells you it's her?" He pauses the game, stares at me for like a whole minute.
"I just look at her. I just know. What's wrong with you? Have you gone crazy?"
My eyes move past him to the walls of basketball players. I want to ask him if he can tell them apart without their jersey numbers or names on the back. When I look at him again, he's still staring at me. Only his features have shifted so that he's brand new. I say, "Never mind. I'm just messing with you." I go back into my room and dig out the old composition notebook I keep hidden away in a drawer and start flipping through it. This is where I sort out the projects I build, drawing them, planning them out. But in between the brainstorms and sketches and blueprints and lists of materials needed, there are passages like these. "Went to Claire's Pizza with the family. Got lost coming back from bathroom. Took me a while to find them. Dad finally had to wave me down. I was so wiped out after Saturday's game, we won in straight innings, I didn't even recognize DeMario Raines when he came up to congratulate me." Every few pages, entry after entry. Nothing earth-shattering or alarming until you start adding them up. As I'm reading them now, a feeling settles over me like a blanket. But not the warm, comforting kind. More like a thick and scratchy blanket thrown over the head just before you're shoved into the trunk of a car. There is something wrong with me. Of all the people in the world, I feel like the girl would understand. I sit there the rest of the night thinking, I hope she makes it. And even though the news is protecting her identity, and all I know is her last name, I write her a letter to tell her this, tuck it into her favorite book, and go online to find the mailing address for the local hospital.
Libby, age 13. Dr. Weiss is thin and tall and probably couldn't gain weight if he tried. He's worried I'm trying to kill myself. I tell him, if I wanted to kill myself, there are faster ways to do it. He stands beside my hospital bed with his arms crossed. His face is hard to read because he does this thing where he can frown and smile at the same time. He says,
"Your father says you've been housebound for 6 months."
"It depends on when you start counting. For 5 months and 24 days, I've been too large to get through the door. But my last day of school was 2 years ago."
"There are two important things we need to understand here. Why you had this panic attack and why you gained the weight. That's what we need to address. It will be a process and it will take time. But we are going to get you healthy again."
I glance at my dad in the armchair across from me. He knows as well as I do what the why is. It's everything changing when I was 10. It's the bullying and the fear. So much fear of everything, but most